Welcome back to the Authentic Dad Podcast. It's David Warren. Thank you very much for listening today. I have the very fascinating Ben Feller, or as George W. Bush refers to him as Feller. Inside joke. You have to listen. It's a great story. Ben is the former chief White House correspondent to the AP, from the AP, and he wrote a new book, a children's book, with a very universal message called Big Problems, Little Problems. It's beautifully illustrated. It's out May 31st. I really hope you enjoy this conversation. Thank you so much.
I'm here with Ben Feller. He is a communications advisor and former award-winning chief White House correspondent for the Associated Press. During his years of covering Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush, he was the leader, was a leader of the White House Press Corps, traveled aboard Air Force One around the world, and was honored as a master of deadline reporting. Now he's writing about his personal passion, being a dad. This is his first book. Ben, let me just mention the name of it. Big Problems, Little Problems, right?
That's right.
Thanks for coming on.
David, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation a lot.
Yeah, as I said, people send me books and I don't always get through them, but your book, cover to cover.
Cover to cover.
All 20-some. So this is a children's book, of course. It's beautifully illustrated. It's very, very sweet, and I want to talk about it. And I've always, if you've ever listened, I always like to hear people's story first. So before the book, you had this long, illustrious, really interesting career. And just give me, just take it away. Tell me how you got here from where you were.
Sure, sure. Well, really, my whole career has been around storytelling, which is a passion of mine. I got into it as a journalist many years ago. I was a graduate of Penn State, grew up in Central Pennsylvania, got in with a local newspaper, and figured out what the hell I was doing at that age. And really just kept striving to figure out, how do I make the complicated simpler? I covered a lot of politics and government and the local level. And then as my career went on, I got into some higher stakes politics in North Carolina and Florida. And then I moved up to the national level, joined the Associated Press in Washington, covered education there. And then the White House, as you mentioned, the Bush and Obama White Houses. And the entire time, no matter what the subject was, I really tried to make my mark by taking complicated, fast-moving subject matters and making them clear and distilled and relevant to the people who really mattered, which was not me, as the reader. And that's how I fashioned my career, and it led to some marvelous and unbelievable life experiences covering presidents. But that's really the underpinning of both my journalism career and then what I did after that, which was to go into business and figure out how to help other people tell their stories. So I've worked with a lot of clients around the country and figure out how to help them figure out who they are. What do they do? Why are they different? Why should people care about their work? And as I was doing all of that, this idea came to me about the children's book, which I'm happy to explain more about, but it's all really part of what.
I'm not going to let you get off that easy. I do have to hear some. So you were the guy, as we talked about in the press conference, where, you know, whoever was up there, you said first question, because AP? Does AP get the first question?
Yeah, by tradition, when tradition still mattered, David, at the White House, AP had as the longest standing wire service of getting the first question. And so there were a few of us in that tiny AP booth, but if it was me in the seat that day, and certainly when I was chief correspondent, I was in the seat in the big moments, the president almost always turned to the AP first. And nothing like that 5 seconds right before the president says, and we're going to start here in the front row. Let's go to Ben Feller, AP, you know.
And was right it then. Both Bush administrations, both Obamas, or what time period?
I covered the end of President George W. Bush's presidency, the last 2 years. And then I covered the first term of President Obama. Wow. So six years in total, which is, you know, in Washington journalism standards for covering the White House, especially for the AP, it feels like a lot longer than 6 years. But you also get a life experience packed into that time that's never going to be replicable. So it was well worth the trade-off.
I'm always curious about like the work-life balance in these jobs. Was it like crazy hours? What was it like? Because you were the chief and the news cycle is so fast and 24/7. And
yeah, it's really not tenable. It certainly, for me, it wasn't. And there are people who have made a life out of it. You know, my boss at the time, who is still a beloved figure in my life, said, you know, this isn't a job and it's not a career, it's a lifestyle. I mean, you just got to get into the lifestyle. And as dramatic as that sounds, it really is. The everything in the world comes through the White House. And if it's potentially newsworthy, it goes through the AP. And if you're the chief correspondent, that means it goes to you. So in that sense, you're always on. Even when you think you're done, you're not. And for a long time, I wanted that and I thrived in it. And that's how I got really good at that job. And that's how you got to earn the respect of national security advisors and chiefs of staffs and vice presidents and presidents. But at the same time, it's good to have a sense of balance, a perspective, and be able to go to sleep at night and not constantly be worrying. You know, I remember changing my son's diaper and that the morning editor calling, and I was saying, you know, this is why we have somebody else at the White House in the mornings, because I'm doing this until I get in. And she said, well, no, I'm asking you because you're the chief correspondent. I mean, it really, when people want an answer, they want it from you. And so the work-life balance definitely took a hit there at the end. And that was one of many reasons why I decided to make a career pivot. But I still look back at the time I did spend there very, very fondly.
Yeah, I bet it was sort of like, as you say, lifestyle, almost like is like politics and being in like the show business, or it's like a really specific, and I imagine no one would really understand what you went through or how, unless they're in the biz.
Yeah.
Do you have any appropriate for podcast audience war stories, like on Air Force One, anecdotes, tidbits that would be sort of like,
Yeah,
I'm sure
many.
there's things that can't be shared in that world, but
Sure. I mean, I'll tell you one which friends of mine know, but it's worth telling if for no other reason than your audience might like it because it's just humiliating to me. So my first foreign trip I covered, I was with President Bush in Africa, and I think we went to five countries. It was really a remarkable trip in lots of ways, including seeing a part of the world that was eye-opening. But at the end of that trip, I had worked so nonstop because I was so earnest and determined to get it right, because that was a big deal at the AP to send a correspondent on a foreign trip, that I got worn down. I ate something I shouldn't have in one of the, you know, press centers, and I got very sick going out of Liberia. And I ended up having to go in the presidential motorcade in the ambulance. And you know, the press corps thought I had, you know, missed the van and was left behind. It was the whole thing was just so embarrassing. But I made it back, got on Air Force One and thought, okay, I'm going home now. I'll make it. I'll survive this. I mean, I was very, very sick. And then of course the president at that moment decides, hey, we're having a news conference in my conference room. And I want the press pool, which is the subset of the press corps who travel with the president on the plane. It's a very small group. There's like 12 of us photographers and writers and one video crew. And so they said, you guys, the writers come up front. My colleague said, Ben, we got it for you. Don't worry about it. I mean, they saw how bad I looked. I'm not even sure they wanted me in the room. And I said, no, I can't miss the president's news conference on my first foreign trip. I'll never get back on the plane. So I walked in, and the president looked right at me as I walked in, and he said, he always called me Feller after he knew my name. He goes, Feller, how you doing, man? I'm like, I'm fine, president. So I sit down, and you know, he says, well, you know, Dana Perino was the press secretary, and she said, all right, well, the president has some comments to make, and I'll take a few questions, and we'll try to keep this short because, as we all know, Ben Feller isn't feeling well. Which wasn't a great way to start off the news conference on Air Force One. So the president describes this as the best trip of his life. And I'm like, oh my gosh, he's really excited. I mean, this is at the end of his presidency. You know, I didn't think he was going to call this the best trip of his presidency, but he was very excited about the work he did. And the first question was about, this was 2008, the first question to him was about Barack Obama. And he didn't really care for that, considering that, you know, that wasn't about what he wanted to talk about. And by the way, he was still the president. Second question was about Barack Obama. So now he's just really angry. And he's like, if you guys want to talk politics, you can do that, but I'm here to talk about other things, you know? And then he gets to me, and with all of that anger and frustration at the press corps, he says, Feller, how you doing, man? I've asked you three times. You will not answer my question. I did answer your question. I said, I'm hanging in there. He's like, huh, well, have you vomited yet today? So there's the first lady and the chief of staff, and I think the national security advisor and they're all just laughing at the idea that I look so pale that even the president is like, just you know, give me a vomiting update, would you? And so
I'm just, and he sells feller, huh? He really did.
Yeah, yeah. And so so I had to get past that sort of shriek of laughter, and I held it together, and I asked him a question about terror surveillance and an upcoming vote. And he's like, okay, he's a serious guy. He brought the room back to center. And you know, but if you Google that, I think if you Google my name and vomiting, you'll see this glorious moment. So there were lots of really funny moments like that where you see the president. I remember seeing President Obama going to the gym at a hotel somewhere, you know, and I was going to get coffee and it was 6 a.m. and I said, "Good morning, Mr. President." You just walk by in the lobby. He goes, "Hey guys, how you doing?" I'm like, "No guys. It's no guys, just me, just a person walking mm-hmm. through here," you know, because mm-hmm. he associated me with this pack of people, you know. And so when you saw them in these odd contexts or these funny moments, those stand out the most. There's a lot of stories I could tell you that are more serious than that one, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones where you're like, that's never going to happen again.
Well, that Ben Feller, he's a true professional.
That trooper.
Puke.
Yeah.
Hold on one second. So, okay, that's cool. How many times were you on Air Force One?
Hundreds.
Hundreds?
Yeah, because I was there for 6 years, and the president on a domestic trip, he might go from Andrews Air Force Base to California to help grieving families who are dealing with, you know, wildfires, and then mm-hmm. make a stop in a different part of the state for a different purpose, and then spend the night in another state and do a fundraiser and go to a policy speech, and then so. All of those trips, you're on and off the plane. So even one trip can have several flights. And then, you know, I flew with him on foreign trips too, where there were many, many legs. And I think I did 25 to 30 of those. So I never counted, but it was a good number. And it never, by the way, got routine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you would think, well, of course not. But I mean, when you do something that often and you show up and you park the car and you go through security and the dog sniff the bags and all that, but man, when I would show up at the base, at the Air Force base, and I would see the tip of the plane out there, I'm like, okay, first of all, I obeyed the number one rule of being a White House correspondent, which is don't miss the plane. And yeah. The second one is, this is always going to be a take your breath away moment. And then you catch your breath and you go to work.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I live, as we talked, right outside DC and, you know, a couple miles from the line. You used to live in Washington, and every time we go into the city and see the Washington Monument or the Capitol building, there is like this, your heart stop, at least for me, it stops a little bit, like, oh my God, there's something about it. It doesn't get old. It's beautiful. You know, I'm proud of this city.
It's how it should be. That's how it should be. I mean, when I lived there, and I lived there for a long time, people would say, hey, I haven't been to Washington, or I haven't been there in a long time. What should I do? And I'd say, mm-hmm. start at the Lincoln Memorial, soak it in and walk to the Capitol. And just take in the mall, because there's nothing like it in the world. And then you can do so many other things.
I have a nephew who goes to GW, and he tends to take, you know, some of his dates to the monuments. The monument walks at night. Very, very romantic for anyone who is looking for my wife and I. Second date, Lincoln Memorial.
There you go. See, I was onto something there. Yeah.
You were.
And look, the perspective that you just shared of it catches your breath. You know, that's something that I really worked on, especially on the hard days at the White House, where I felt like I wasn't getting anywhere. And there were days like that, for sure. And I'd walk out the driveway at the end of the day and I'd think about who won today, me or the White House. And you think, well, that's kind of a very transactional way to talk about it. But in the fight for information, that's what it was like. And I would walk down the driveway and be in my head about it. And I'd go through the Secret Service booth and the gate, and you shut the door, and the second gate would clang. An old-fashioned sound, right? Metal on metal.
Mm-hmm.
And the people walking along Pennsylvania Avenue would hear that and look and say, who just came out of that gate? You know, and they'd give you this.
Absolutely. Like, I do that still.
You got to be in there. Who are you? What's going on? Should I care about you? And I'd always look back like, you have no reason to care about me. I'm the guy that covers the people. but I would remember based on their look.
All the time.
Yeah. The look on their faces would remind
downtown,
me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When we see people come out, if we're walking around that area, whatever, sightseeing, whatever, and we're like, who's that? Who's that? Does anyone recognize that person? Who's that? And you know, totally doing that. And I just want to say, like, thank you for doing what you did. And we need good journalists. And I'm sure there are a lot of really aspiring. It's a very hard job. But even before fake news phenomenon and, right. and the war on journalism and all that, it's just really, it seemed like very hard to break into, very hard to get. It's sort of like a dream job you had probably for lots and lots of people. And hard work, important work. So thank you. We need good journalists. And
I appreciate that. I share that journalism career. I share that belief every day. I have a lot of friends who are still in it, in the fight, who are either in the jobs that they were in when I met them and are loving it still, or they've moved on to editor roles or management roles. But either way, I have a lot of respect for it and what they do. And it's not that often that you hear what you just said, which is just sort of beyond the magic and the access, the importance of it and the grind of it.
So. During our previous unnamed administration, we were told that it would be good to support like journalism, you know, like subscribe to Washington Post, New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, name your, you know, and we did. And it was like, it felt like an important civic duty.
Right.
To do so, because as we all know, in the Instagram, Facebook, Twitter world, everybody's a journalist. You know, everybody has a microphone, everybody has a platform, which can be good, but can also be really, really dangerous. So, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but I do. I respect what you did, and that was for. And so the AP chief was what. 4, 6 years? How many years?
So I was in the White House booth of the AP for 6 years. I was the lead correspondent for, I think, the last two of those years.
And so what was the next? Because you're a man that is, I love it, like sort of this living this creative life. What was after that?
Yeah, so I made a pivot. That was in 2013. I wasn't sure, David, what I wanted to do next. I knew that I wanted to have more work-life balance, to your earlier point. I wanted to see if I could take my journalism skills and parlay them into something else that would be interesting to me, be invigorating. And also, you know, I've got bills to pay, like everybody who's listening to this. And so I decided to go into business, and I worked for a firm for a long time. That focused on strategic communications, which is basically saying a lot of people out there have problems figuring out how to communicate what it is that they do and why it's important and how to get people to listen and care and donate and or attend their school or shop at their business. And so I really like the idea of helping leaders of companies and organizations with their problem solving, their strategic problem solving through the prism of communications. And so that's really
and
been
telling their story, right? Because that's what you do. Here's
telling their story. Yeah. I mean, I break down a lot of my work, as you and I were talking about earlier, to the questions of who are you and what do you do? And you'd be surprised perhaps at how often people struggle with those two questions, and particularly being able to explain it in plain English. Mm-hmm. And then the other two questions I add, which are how is it different?
Yep.
And why should people care? And those are competitive questions, right? And those questions really take digging and shaping. And so when you come out the other side of that, you've helped people find their voice, find their distinctiveness, and walk around their lives with a lot more pride and power because they've got it nailed. And that's, you know, that comes out of being a journalist. But it also comes from understanding how the world works. The world doesn't work in this clean, linear way that says, okay, we've figured out what we're doing. Why aren't people responding? As if it's like their fault. You know, it's your job.
Exactly. And
your job
is
for them to care.
Yeah, on a very, very micro level, when I started doing podcasting and coaching, I noticed, you know, everyone said you have to have a niche or you have to. But distilling your story and who you are and what you do where people can connect to it, isn't that easy? I think it's a little easier as when for my law practice, because that's sort of like a plumber, you know, I fix your pipe. If you spring a leak, you get a ticket or DUI. Like, but there are organizations that aren't, you know, if you're not an accountant or an attorney, although I would imagine those kinds of professions may need to tell their story too. But like nonprofits or, I don't know, or other businesses, it's really an art form to do
it
that.
It is an
well.
Art form, and oftentimes what happens is people don't realize how difficult it is until they have a reason to care about it, right? Mm-hmm. If somebody at their organization says, I'm really unhappy with our ability to do X, and the diagnosis is that's because we're just not communicating well, and we don't have the people inside who can do it. And it's once you reach that correct diagnosis and that self-awareness, then you go and you turn to somebody who can do it. That's what we do in life, right? You solve problems, and if you can't solve the problems, you have the awareness to try to get help. And so I'm the help on storytelling. And there's a lot of people who do this well, but it begins with that. As you said, I don't think it's still fully appreciated. People tend to think of storytelling communications as either the last thing you do or a luxury that you might get to. When you think about
it, afford it or something.
Core to what you do, it's a different mindset.
Yeah, right. I'm sure there's a lot of we do great work and we're a great organization and we're honest, hardworking people. Why isn't our message not getting through? Why aren't we connecting?
Right.
I know nothing about this business, but I can imagine that's what happens.
That's what happens all the time. And so then it becomes a market opportunity, but a strategic challenge to convince them you could have more impact.
Yeah.
People got it and they had reason to care. And so then you got to decide whether you want to commit to that and who you want to commit with and how much can you afford to spend on it and what are you looking for on the other side. But it's all the best clients I've worked with have said in some form or fashion, we appreciate where we ended up with the language, but more importantly, you've changed the way we think.
Mm-hmm.
You've changed the way we think about ourselves. You've changed the way we think about the world and our place in it. Like, that's heady work. That's interesting.
A lot of reframing.
Yeah.
All right. Let's pivot, as they say, the 2022, 2021 word, because you came here for something very specific. I want to give ample time to the book, which is beautiful and sweet and the illustrations are fantastic. And I was having a little bit of a hard morning, I'll be honest. And I was like, okay, let's see, you know, Ben's coming on, let's read his book. And it was like, it like softened me.
Oh, that's great.
I have kids. I have two kids. I have a 10 and a 13. And your son is how old?
He's 10.
He's 10. I'm great. Yeah. And just tell us about this. How did that come about and why the book?
Well, first of all, that reaction that it softened you on a hard morning is wonderful. Appreciate you telling me that. And you know, you're the authentic dad, and that is an authentic reaction, and one that I haven't gotten yet. As you know, not a lot of people have read this book yet as we do this together, but the initial reactions are really affirming, and they're a version of that, which is I can use this. I'm affected by this. It's not just for kids. It's for parents. So
definitely not just for kids. Yeah.
Yeah. So the gist is that the story is about a father and a son who help make life's daily challenges a little bit easier to solve. And it begins with the dad teaching the son. In this case, this is a true story of me with my son, Sam. As I watched him, as happens with a lot of kids, feel like whatever is bothering him in that moment is the end of the world. If you can't zip your zipper, if you can't find your toy, if you can't remember what you were going to say, like, these are things that are just can seem overwhelming. And we know as parents watching our kids that they're not that big of a deal because we have the perspective of life that they don't. But it's our job to not just say that, you know, the sort of the version of calm down. That's not that helpful. Mm-hmm. What if you actually got, you know, to the point where you could make the big problem smaller? And so that's what I would do with Sam. I would get into a routine of calming him down, taking deep breaths, getting on one knee so we were eye to eye, getting close to him. And immediately things got softer, as you said. And then we'd solve the problem. And, you know, I can help you zip your coat. I can help you find your toy. We'll find another toy. And then he began to realize that these were not big problems. These were little problems. And that was how we framed it. Big problem or little problem. Once you know it's a little problem, it's not a big deal, you instantly are lighter and you solve it and you go on. You're not thinking about it. You're not worried about it. And so that's the pillar of the book, David, but really what turned it around and made it to the point where I thought I should do something with this. I think other people might love this.
Yeah.
So is when Sam started teaching me that he had not only heard my lessons, but when he saw me get frustrated, he reflected it back. Daddy, big problem or little problem? You know, breathe in and out. And that actually happened. And it happened one day when I was driving and I thought, oh my gosh, like, it's just one of those moments as a parent, you think it's working, you know, like I did something right. But as a writer, you think, oh my gosh, I should write that down. And so that's where the story came from. And it took a lot of process and work to get it from that anecdote to where we are with the book about to come out and be available in stores. But that's where the idea came from. And it's from the heart.
Yeah, because I was thinking, I guess we, as parents, we have this idea that we're the teachers, we're the ones teaching them. And I don't want to say I didn't think my kids have nothing to teach me, but when I was reading that book, it brought back a few times where it happened to me. I was worried about this like little thing on my head, thinking like, oh, am I sick of skin cancer or something? And I remember my daughter was like, you know, that's nothing, right? Like, kind of, and I was like, she's right. She's like, why are you worried about that? I don't think that's anything. You know, she's not a dermatologist, but what I think she was picking up on that I was very anxious and obsessing and something that very, very small. And even if it was something that's not going to be, you know, a big problem. Necessary.
Yeah, it's exactly true, you know, and the cornerstones of the book are on the themes of frustration, perspective, and patience.
Well, so, I do have to ask, I don't know if it's all autobiographical because I don't want to spoil it, but there's a scene where the young man spills the coffee all over your papers. That happened to me, except I'm the one who did it. And I was like, oh God, it's very painful when that happens. Mm-hmm. Did that happen? Or is that?
Yeah, it's one of these things where if it was, you know, the TV movie, you'd say like based on real events.
Yeah.
The real story on that, which is sort of just a little cleaner to say it the way we did in the book, was when I was driving and I was, anybody who's familiar with New York City can understand, I hope, this frustration I felt trying to get back into the city through the Holland Tunnel. Yeah. Which is to my knowledge, not doable. I've tried to do it many times and eventually you get through, but you just, as anyway, I was maddeningly frustrated this particular day and could not just get anywhere. And I let loose with some language that would not be appropriate, not only for a children's book, but even for your audience.
Oh, and, no, it's open season here, but I know what you mean.
And Sam was in the car seat. And he might not have understood the words I used, but he understood the tone of my voice and he could see it in my face. And so through the rearview mirror, he said, Daddy. And I looked up, he said, don't get frustrated. Big problem, little problem. So then I'm looking in the mirror at my son and I'm looking ahead at the traffic and thinking, he just taught me what I've been trying to teach him right then.
What
difference does it make? If the light turns green and nobody moves, like you're not going to sit here forever. You're going to get home. He's safe. You're safe.
Yeah.
Just calm down and breathe and you'll get there. And that's what happened in the book. So that did really happen. And he still does it sometimes. He'll still remind me to have perspective. And that's what we lose. That's really what they can teach us, to your point.
Yeah.
Is that you got to get that email done? Do you really? I know you started to write it, but when they want to show you a drawing or they want to come and ask you a question, what's more important right then? And so that's not I figured it out. I'm never going to have to do that again. I think it's a constant thing. I'm still doing it too, but I'm much better at it now because
that happens all the time. And
you're not going to get the moment back with the kid, you know?
I know. The email can wait. I just need to write this. Well, actually you don't, but I'd feel a lot better if I could write this. It's like, you don't need to write that.
You don't.
And there's a lot of wisdom with the young ones. And I think since they're human, you know, there's intuition there. And they pick up on energy and our energy. And
they absolutely do. Yeah. Yeah. And one other point from the book is that, you know, I talk about frustration and patience and the boy in the book doesn't know what those words mean.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. What for us? What? What is that? Oh, I'm not just going to label the thing that you're feeling. I'm going to explain to you what it means, and so that you get it. And so, and I still do that with him. I was putting Sam to bed the other night, and he was making some joke about being on, you know, so-and-so had led a perilous journey. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, really? Do you know what perilous journey means? Do you know what perilous means? He's like, no. I'm like, okay, well, let's, that's hilarious, but let's try to use words that we know or ask when we don't. So do you know what peril means? No. Okay, well, peril is danger. So he went on a dangerous journey, like trying to cross one of those bridges over a river, you know, where it might fall. Like, that's peril. Okay, yeah. Great. So, you know, these little moments are fun. And it doesn't all have to be solving a problem. It could just be, you know, teaching. And so we have a lot of fun with words like that. And sometimes I ask him and he does know. And I'm like, huh, where'd you learn that? He's like, oh, I learned things, Dad. You're not the only one.
Right. So he would be what, fifth grade?
Yes. Or fourth? He's, yeah. He's about to, he's coming around the corner here and finishing the end of fifth grade.
All right. Middle school.
Middle school awaits.
How did you, if you don't mind sharing, get in touch, or how did the illustration or the illustrator, how did that happen? Because I really like the illustration. It's really
good. Yeah. The illustrator for the book is Merce Lopez, who's got a renowned career in her own right. That was all handled by the publisher of the book. Tilbury House Publishing, Tilbury House Publishers in Maine, acquired the book and began the process shortly thereafter of finding an illustrator. And everything about this part of the process was completely new to me. This all happened during the pandemic. And so there was a lot of learning by me, and also, you know, kind of having to have patience, like, okay, as the publisher told me, your part is kind of done. You know, you've written the book, you found us, we like it, we want to make the book. The illustrator is essential to the success of this. We have to choose the right one, find he or she, get them, see if they're interested, see if they have time. And then we have to give them the time to do it right. And all of that has to happen during a pandemic when everybody's frayed and the publishing industry is, you know, like everything else for a while was sort of frozen. And so they did consult me at key moments to say, here's where we're headed, here's who we've chosen. But there was also a lot of months in there where it was kind of, you need to be patient, and we'll let you know as soon as we have something to show you. And so that's how it happened. In fact, I only really had my first contact with her directly recently, a couple of weeks ago. That whole process, everything was through the publisher, as is protocol. And I said, I'd really like to be able to just send her a note. And they said, sure. Mm-hmm. So draft what you want, we'll send it on. And she wrote back and said, thank you for your words. By the time I finished the book, I really felt like the father and the son were my friends.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that cool, right? Yeah. That's just a really elegant phrase.
I was looking through, as you were just saying, that the illustrations, I'm not sure how to describe it, but it's like perfect for the word. Like she knew, they picked the great one. She knows what she's doing. Like it. Yeah, I mean, I could imagine if you didn't have the right, I don't know anything about children's books, but if you didn't have the right illustrator, it wouldn't work as well.
Right. And that was a case where they obviously have done this so well for so long, the publishers, and have a sense for that, the touch. They're the pros at it. The illustrations are evocative and they're playful. That's how I think about them. But they're also very true to life because she used a lot of photographs that I had put together for her. I sent them to her as a guide, as an inspiration. Here's what we look like. Here's what his room looks like. Here's what we play like. Here's what our looks like when you walk out the stoop of our brownstone in Brooklyn. And she didn't just use them as sort of a general inspiration. She used them more as a literal one. And so, you know, when Sam's looking for a cape in his bedroom, I'm looking in his bedroom right now talking to you. It's his room with his stuffed animals. And so that adds a whole nother level of personal touch to this that's really his.
What does he think about it, the book?
You know, he's excited at a certain level. He's 10-year-old excited that, you know, this has happened. And I think he's kind of excited for me, but it's not real to him. It's an abstraction, you know, like daddy wrote a book and it's about us and he's seen the illustrations, but even in a screen-based generation, it's not the same thing as when it's going to come and he can hold it, you know, and then we'll see, what, you know, if there's reaction to it among his friends at school,
Yeah.
you know. So it's still a little bit removed for him, but he's definitely proud. And we've got one of the illustrations printed out on our fridge, and he looks at it sometimes and kind of shakes his head like, I can't believe I'm in a book, you know?
That's what it, yeah, I think there are still bookstores in the world, especially in Brooklyn and Manhattan, and I wonder if he, you know, walks into one one day and sees it, it might be a lot more real. There I am.
Not only that, that's the moment that I'm looking forward to the most. Really, what you just said, I mean, somebody asked me, how are we going to celebrate? And that would be a celebration because there are some beloved bookstores we go to here. And if we're walking by and it's in the window,
Oh,
I'm like,
yeah.
and that goes back to what I told the publisher. I said, and we talked about all these different scenarios. And I said, listen, I really just want a beautiful book made so I can hand it to my son. And he
When does
said,
it
oh,
officially come out? It hasn't come out yet, or has?
it is no, it's in the
Pre-ordered.
pre-order stage. So it's available now, but it is slated to be released on May 17th. And ahead of Father's Day, which was a goal of ours, and that date as of this moment might slip, but so far they're confident it won't.
Well,
So
I'm going to be
it's coming
sure
soon.
to get this out to this conversation out so it can be good timing. Sometimes I just, you know, that's good. It's good to know. What, any book, like a little book tour, a little talk around town,
You know,
anything
that's
else?
kind of coming together right now, those plans as we speak. There's a couple of bookstores that I've been in touch with here in Brooklyn that are willing to either do an event for me or you know, make sure it's prominently sold. So if people want to come and meet me or Sam or get an autograph as one place offered. But we might do more with it as well. We might do some work in the Manhattan bookstores. Some of that depends on what's going to happen organically, you know, if people ask to be part of it or the local libraries want me to come by. So that's almost the sort of to be determined fun part of this.
Well, if you want, if you ever come by the beloved Politics and Prose, as a former Washingtonian, you know, that's like one of the
It's a
best
spot.
bookstores in America. I'll be sure to tell all my people, and that would be fun, and love to see it in person. And I don't have any affiliation with them, but I just love that bookstore, and I'm sure you know it.
I love that bookstore too, from when I
Great.
used to live not that far from Politics and Prose. And I
Still
hadn't even
goes.
really got to the point of thinking about DC stores, but that's a great idea.
Yeah, you know, you're a DC, former DC guy, you know,
Right.
maybe Barack or W might fly in.
Yeah.
Fella, you know, who
I,
knows?
the part of the really, I genuinely hope part of the appeal for this is for people who would love the book is it's not just for parents of young kids. I'd say that's an obvious and certainly intended audience.
I
But
don't
there
think it is either. It's not like a Dr. Seuss book, but it's the sense that, like, you know, when I graduated high school, my parents got me, "Oh, the places you'll go," where this is a simple message kind of cloaked in a children's book, and it's like, "Oh, this," but it's actually a more sophisticated universal message, which is well done, my friend.
Thank you. I like
I guess a
that. I
lot of
like
children's books are like that, but this one spoke to me because I worry a lot. You know, I'm an anxious, I have a history of anxiety, so I'm like, oh, it's just this, you know, it spoke to me.
Well, that's great. And listen, I've done a lot of reflecting during the pandemic about life's daily challenges and you know, the pursuit of happiness, which is so important. And I think a lot of people are frustrated. A lot of people are anxious, whether it's in a clinical sense or in a more informal sense. And I thought, who couldn't use a little bit of help on how to make life easier? Like, I just don't know how that's not universal. If you've figured out life to the point where you really don't need a way to have some patience and perspective when something goes wrong, you've kind of solved that, then I'd like to read your book because it's just not the life that I lead. It's all around us in small ways, all the time. And so having perspective about how to breathe, how to smile, how to make your kid happier, how to watch your kid make you happier. If it happens once a day, that's one win, you know?
Yeah, no, as soon, and it always happens to me where as soon as I think I got it, got the world by the balls, comes back, something happens.
Right.
Damn, thought I
You well,
had
you
this
get it.
down.
You get it, my man.
Damn. But I would just say, like, the other thing that comes to mind is these like sweet little moments, you know, you're saying and explaining him the vocabulary before he goes to bed and when I take my kids to school or wait on the bus stop. And I've talked about this before, even it's just there's like little moments, it's 5 minutes before the bus comes, or we're kids' middle school's across the street basically, but we drive to cross a busy road, and that just like a little bit of time every morning is so sacred. And it's just you just have these really funny interactions, and it's like part of the routine, and those
it's the
I'll
best.
Cherish those, you know, forever.
No, it's the best. I just want to add one thing to that. So, you know, my son goes to school here in New York City, and so for now, our routine, we used to take the bus. Long story short, with the pandemic, that's not really an option. So I take him on the subway. It's 3 stops door to door. So in that sense, it's easy. But I took him recently, and we got to the top of the steps where you go through the turnstile, and a couple of the kids he knows just went by themselves, and the mom stayed, and so she didn't feel the need to walk them up, and it's $2.75 a time. So why walk in just to pay, right, to come back in? And I'm like, oh, I never thought about that. He's 10. He could walk up the steps and turn the side, you know. But I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. And the reason was I didn't trust him or I didn't feel safe in that moment. It's that I want to walk him up because if I get up there and they haven't opened the doors yet, which is often the case, you're standing in line and you might wait for 4 minutes or 6 minutes or whatever. But in those 6 minutes, it's just that quality time where he's teasing and playing and telling a story and we're going over the day and who's going to pick him up. And like, I love that. So I'm like, I would rather swipe an extra time and come back on the subway to get the 6 minutes. And you know what? He would rather me be up there too.
Exactly. So the bus stop for my daughter is literally in front of, well, it's across the street, but I'm talking, it's like 20 feet from our house. She's 10. She could walk out the house. I could see her from the window. She could stay with the other kids. We go out every morning. Why? Does she need it? No, but am I going to, I could send an extra email, or I could just stand there, fresh air, talk to the other parents. It's something about it. You know, that moment. It's not really about what the kid not being able to do it for themselves is, right? You know. So, you know, I don't know. And it goes fast. Very, very fast.
It goes fast. And that's, you know, David, that's part of the real joy about the book is, for me personally, is the stories I wrote for a lot of years for newspapers and then for the AP, they had so much importance at the time. You know, by definition, they were daily stories. And some of them had real impact over time, you know, a smaller number. But this one's permanent, you know, this book will be here. And, you know, no matter how well it does commercially, the point is it's doing well sort of in a spiritual sense because it's done and it's going to be great. And Sam will hopefully cherish it for a long time, especially when he's 18, 20, older, you know. The marker for his childhood, it's permanent. And because the moments aren't going to last long, but hopefully one like this will.
Is Ben Feller and Throw Up, is that permanent? Let me see. Ben Feller. I'm going to Google that. Throw Up. Is that
Ben Feller and Vomit.
And Vomit. Is that, that's permanent, right? Ben Feller, Vomit. Let's see. I'll look later. But
yeah. Don't look too hard. Last time somebody Googled it, it was there, but you know, we don't need to dwell on that.
No, just that's what you call in comedy the callback. I'm calling back the first
callback.
The callback. So, what? Anything else? I mean, is there any other things that in authors, people, humans that beside your son and your life that like inspired you or that you would point to? And on you could be, I'm putting you on the spot. I always like to hear like other. You know, what wisdom do you like to consume, if any?
Well, I mean, I guess I have two answers to that. I mean, I'm inspired by a lot of people in my life. You know, my family, Sam's got a wonderful, loving mom and we're close. And, you know, I try to learn from and take the best from all of them. And that... Mm-hmm. You know, informs how I live my life. And also, you know, I'm always making choices about what I want to do next, whether it's what's next in my career or what's next. Maybe another book. We'll see what happens with this one. In terms of, you know, what I consume, my My habits are sort of blissfully and intentionally all over the place. I'd love to give you kind of a rigid discipline, but it's not that way. I go through spurts of reading very dark, mystery novels set in, gray London to some of my friends who are still in journalism wrote a series of, books coming out of the Trump presidency, and I read that, and I read the Obama memoir, which came out, I think, last year, and that prompted me actually to go back and reread Bush's since I had covered both of those guys. Lately I've been actually reading some books about work-life balance and parenting because I've been in that mind space. Figuring out, how to make more sense of the world coming out of a pandemic. So, and then from a news perspective, again, there's just so much out there. I read places that you'd expect, and occasionally a tip sheet will lead me into other places that are new reading for me. So, it's a little bit
You have
all
a
over the
new,
place.
you still like a news junkie? A little bit or no?
I wouldn't say I'm a news junkie in the sense. I know plenty of news junkies who would talk to me for 7 hours about that, what I did at the White House. And I've become more selective and in when I engage because I am very interested in it. But part of it is the time, but also part of it is, I just spent so long, David, in that cauldron that choosing when to engage and how deep is a real luxury, frankly. So sometimes I'll read a lot, and sometimes I'll get the headlines, and I'll go back to sports or travel, and escape, So I'd say I'd always have a good awareness. It's not gonna be often where there's gonna be major events happening in the city or the state or nationally or globally that I won't know what you're talking about. But I'm not gonna be as voracious about it as I used to because I'm just in a different stage of life.
Yeah, it's like when you're reading Bush's memoir, it's like, it's more than interesting. You were there. I remember
Yeah.
that. I was on the plane when that happened.
For a lot of that's right. So you kind of go deep and then you step out of it because this stuff, look, politics is interesting, but it's also consuming and a lot of it gets negative. It's sort of the stories of how occasionally things get done around a lot of things not getting done. And, if you're trying to maximize the time you have and be purposeful, it can be a little bit toxic for me to get too deep into, the politics
Yeah,
of
I
it.
know
And
what you mean. I
so you're
struggle
interested.
a little bit with it because I want to be engaged, like a good citizen, and then but it is kind of toxic and overwhelming. And what's the right sweet spot to get the information, be engaged, but also not, drown in it?
Yes, that's where I aim to be too, for sure.
Well, sir, anything else before we end this fine conversation I had with you?
I want to say thanks to you for giving voice to the important voice, I think, of authentic dads. There's a hell of a lot of us out there who are doing the job of parenting because we're supposed to, because we're good at it, but also because we love it. We really, really love it. And my ability to share one story about that hopefully will reach other people and they'll have fun with it the way you did. But having a focus on it like you have around your day job is something that I appreciate. So thanks for giving me some platform to talk about the book. And anybody who's listening who wants to know more, they can find me online and happy to have a conversation.
Very good point. We'll put it in the show notes. And where can they find you online?
Yeah, they could find me online, lots of places. Certainly on LinkedIn as a place professionally. I've got social media. Find me on Instagram. I'm very active there with pictures of my son. I've actually got two handles, one for me, one for the book.
Oh,
Ben
nice.
Feller NY is a good place to go. And I will. I'm also working on a website that will be up soon called Big Problems, Little Problems, that will focus on the book and what I'm doing, and that'll be another place to go. So lots of places. You shouldn't within 5 minutes, 5 seconds, you should be able to find me. You don't need to look up the vomiting story. Just look up
I was going to ask you, did you vomit today, Feller? Feller?
the
It's funny. I when you were telling the story, I was like, what, Feller? What, that's his last name. But then I was like, I thought he was just calling you like Fella, like, because he's from Texas.
Yeah.
Fella,
First I
Fella.
was AP man because I worked AP man.
AP
Come on
man.
over here. And then
Come on
it
there,
was Feller.
Feller.
Yeah, I'm not sure he
That's
actually
funny.
called me Ben ever.
man, we don't do first names.
We don't do first names. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, thank you so much. Have a great weekend, and looking forward to this thing coming out.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I enjoyed it a lot. Appreciate it.
Take care, man.
And there you have it. That was my conversation with Ben Feller. Check out the book out May 31st, probably on Amazon or wherever books are sold. I'll put a thing in the show notes. Perfect. Perfect for Father's Day or any occasion. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much for listening. Reach me at furthur.coach. Please consider a 5-star review, a like, pass it forward. Take care. Have a great day.